Hey everyone, it's Hannah. I wanted to quickly ask, if you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. It goes a long way in getting the show in front of other listeners. If you listen on a platform that doesn't do reviews, please follow us on social media, like the show, or leave a comment. Thank you. We love you guys, and we hope you enjoy the show. You're listening to The Tales We Tell, a podcast about spooky stories, unsolved mysteries, and local lore. I'm your host, Hannah Parch,
and I'm Katie.
Welcome back! We're a little bit better than last week.
A little bit.
We got cake this time.
That's the only thing that's better.
And we have Prosecco. Mm-hmm. We're pretending we're celebrating something.
This bottle was weird in a lot of ways. So when I was opening, you know, untwisting the cage, if you'll notice.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It broke off.
Uh-huh.
Like, as I'm, like, untwisting it, it's like, okay, well, that was unique.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm just sitting here, holding it by the neck, waiting for you to come back so that I can pop it with my fancy champagne opener.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm just sitting here reading my book. All of a sudden, pop. So, that's why you didn't get the cool pop noise that I was like, I'm totally prepared to open this bottle. I'm going to get it on recording. It's going to sound awesome.
No. It sounded really dramatic from the kitchen.
Yeah. And then my startled, oh my God.
I'm just glad nothing broke. Well, I can at least say that as an improvement from last week, or last time we recorded, my car did get fixed. Not that night, but they did figure out what was wrong with it that night.
Mm-hmm.
Special shout out to my brother-in-law, James. He's still my brother-in-law, who has been dealing with my car for 11 years. God bless him. He's the one who figured out the problem. And then he told me what it could be, and I told Jarek, and Jarek didn't believe me. And then 30 minutes later, James told him, and he believed him.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Anyways, my car's better.
Walker has an ear infection and is teething.
Mm.
So, and then my mother-in-law was in town this weekend, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's exhausting, entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a really big, fun, busy day yesterday. You know, we did farmer's market. And then we went to Union Point and, you know, sat on a blanket and just kind of played in the park for a little bit before going to the Blueberry Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Where Walker got to see they had a little petting zoo thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he got to pet a bunny and he pet a chicken.
Oh.
And he was fascinated by the chicken wire and the tarp that was partially over.
How did you do with that chicken?
I touched a chicken.
Oh, okay. Good for you.
I mean, we stayed outside of the pen and so, like, stuck our fingers through.
Mm-hmm. Brave.
And, you know, he got to pet a goat and a sheep. I'll show you the pictures later. It's adorable.
I don't want to see the goat.
No pictures of the goat.
Good.
When we first rolled up, I mean that literally because Carver and Critter were in their strollers. And we're like, oh, boys, look, you know, what do you think? The animals.
Mm-hmm.
And they were watching, and then the sheep started baa really loud.
Uh-huh.
It scared Carver big time. He started crying and carrying on, and Walker was just staring, completely unaffected by this really loud, bleating sheep. And that's BLEATING, not BLEEDING, because bleeding and bleeding sound similar.
And he should be terrified of a bleeding sheep.
Yeah, then we've got a problem.
If he was fascinated by the bleeding sheep, then you have another problem on your hands.
He wasn't fascinated by any sheep at all. There was a bit of a blue tarp kind of draped over one edge of the pen to create a shaded area for the animals. That's what he was fascinated with, just watching the tarp, because it was kind of slowly moving in the breeze. I mean, you know how he is. He loves all things like safety labels. The splash pad today, he was fascinated by the drain.
Of course.
And I was like, yeah, that's my kid.
You have a weird kid.
Yeah. And then after the Blueberry Festival, of course, we had our friends going away party.
Oh, yeah, I missed that.
You did.
But I did see that she got engaged, which was very exciting. Mm-hmm. I texted her.
So, anyhow, he had a big weekend.
My next announcement is a correction on a previous announcement. I did my shout out to Tim wrong with the Sally fucking ride. It wasn't his daughter. It was his son. And then I have a note that says...
For shame.
I know. It says, just read the post this time. Which I will now do so that I don't get it wrong. Because I apologized to him. I was like, I just realized... I was writing back to him and I was like, I am just now realizing that I got your shout out wrong. Okay, he said... I wish I could copy a picture on this message board. My 16-year-old son, Thomas, handed me a quarter that had Sally fucking ride on it. He only knows who she is thanks to Katie. And then when I apologized, he said, my daughter liked the undeserved shout out. Thomas was smile frowning. So, Thomas, this is your official shout out.
Now you can... Smile, smile.
Smile, smile. And also...
Or smile, smile, frown some more if you want. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Yeah. Also, possibly stop listening at this point because my next announcement is our rating for this episode, which I've decided is MA-17. But we all know Tim's kids are mature, so, you know, do what you want, Thomas. I don't know. Or ask your dad. But yeah, little ears. So Dante and Tiny Tim.
Bye-bye, boys.
Go away. Can't listen to this. It's got some mature content. I probably should put a content warning in here, but I didn't. So it's just for like general gore, just some graphic stuff. Okay.
Bring on the violence. Sorry, I'm almost done with my surprise cake.
Oh, yeah. I forget. There is kind of a gross. Well, I don't know. You're not grossed out very easily. Mm-mm. Okay. So never mind.
No, I don't get queasy.
If you are eating, gentle listeners, if you're eating surprise cake, pause.
Then
pause that.
Lucky you.
Lucky you. But pause that for a minute because this first part is a little gnarly. July 24th of 1974, Sandra Lee, who is 9, was walking her dog with her sister along the beach at Race Point Dunes in Provincetown, Massachusetts. If you don't know where Provincetown is, it's like...
Oh. In Massachusetts?
Okay. Do you know which part of Massachusetts?
The hooky part?
The hooky part. Good job. I literally said it's the northern tip of the hook. And it's Cape Cod area, you know, whatever. And Sandra and her family had camped at those dunes every summer, so they were, like, really familiar with it. They were camping there that summer, you know, normal place for them to be walking. So her dog suddenly runs ahead of her, like... she has seen something. So Sandra's like, oh, gotta follow the dog. Mm-hmm. And then the first thing that Sandra remembered about this instance was hearing something that she would later describe as sounding like a string of pearls being rubbed together. So she's hearing what sounds like a pearl necklace just kind of clicking together.
Okay.
And then as she gets closer to where her dog is, she smells something kind of putrid. She is at the beach, though, so she's like, maybe it's just low tide. And then she comes across something. About 15 feet across from the access road in heavy brush was the naked body of a woman lying face down on a green beach towel. This is a quote from Sandra. Her hair was a mess, and I could see a gouge in the right side of her neck. Her arms were tucked down in the sand. Also, her body was covered in thousands of maggots, which Sandra would later realize was the sound she heard. Hmm. Did you know that maggots make a sound?
Not, because maggots are always, anytime I've ever encountered maggots, there's always been an overwhelming odor.
Yeah.
And I can't handle that, because I have with a nose this big, I gotta be able to smell well, right? I've always been able to smell really well, and so I'm very sensitive to smells.
Yeah.
Like, I can handle watching gore all day.
Yeah.
But if I have to smell it,
Yeah. When I first read that detail, I was like, what the hell are we talking about? And then I Googled what do maggots sound like? And it, without context, like if someone were just to play the audio for you, it does kind of just sound like.
I want
to
hear it. I'm going to look it up.
Look it up. And like, I can't tell if it is like a wet sound or if it's like a clicking sound, like their mouths. I don't like whatever's breathing in that video. But yeah, that little clicky sound.
Ignore the weird... Ugh. That's creepy, the heavy breathing over it.
Someone is also saying that to their friend as they're listening to our podcast. They're like, ignore the heavy breathing that they do sometimes.
Well, I'm going to apologize in advance for my cough.
So, Sandra and her sister did not tell their parents about this body that they found. They were really freaked out.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see young girls, like, being so freaked out and then not telling anyone.
Yeah. But luckily, 2 days later, another girl, Leslie Metcalf, who was 12, was also walking her dog in the same area. Unfortunately, stumbled across the same thing. Unfortunately, because now, like, 3 children have this trauma. She told an adult, and police were called. So, police come to the scene. This is kind of what they find as they are gathering evidence and securing the scene, whatever that looked like in 1974. So, the woman was between 25 and 35 years old. She was 5'6", and she had, quote, an athletic build. She had long auburn hair that was tied back in a ponytail with a glittery ponytail holder. And I don't know why that was important, but everywhere mentioned that it was a glittery ponytail holder. And her toenails were painted pink. There was a pair of Wrangler jeans and a blue bandana found folded underneath her head. She had a severe wound on the left side of her head, which was later determined to be her cause of death. And one article described this as having completely crushed the left side of her head. The gash in her neck was so severe that, quote, her head was nearly severed from her body. And investigators believed that this had been done by a military entrenching tool or something similar.
I guess, would that have been post-mortem then, if the head wound was the cause of death?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Because nearly decapitating would otherwise be, I would say, cause of death.
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad that they, like, clarified, too, because I was like, there's a lot of injuries and... Which one? Thankfully, yeah, postmortem.
Which came first, the head or the neck?
Thankfully, the head. But then some sources also said that some sources phrased that she had been, quote, nearly decapitated, possibly from strangulation. But it was like, but she also had a huge gash in her neck that wasn't caused by strangulation doesn't cause huge bloody gashes.
Well, if she's been garroted, then yeah, maybe.
Yeah, but I did not get the sense that was, I mean, was what it was.
But I mean, if they've been garroted, would that be classified as... No, I think it would still probably...
Well, garroted with, like, a wire.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
That's what a garrot is a wire.
Well, I thought you could make a garrot out of anything. I mean, thought it was just the act of using a tool to twist.
I don't know. I don't know what the semantics are of garrot.
Oh, man. I also got the impression that, like, the neck wound and the... Oh, no, I did say this. The neck wound was caused by a military entrenching tool. So, like, a shovel. Yeah. Like a tiny shovel.
Yeah.
What I assume is a tiny shovel. So, also... So, remember when Sandra finds her hands were, like... down in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
No, they weren't. They were missing. Mm-hmm. Probably also hacked off by the tool.
I did think that was interesting that they were down in the sand, because mm-hmm. I'm like, that's an interesting way of, like, it sounds like she's just kind of been placed there or mm-hmm. dumped there. I don't know how, like, unless they were under her, it just seems weird that they would be in the sand.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to let it go. But
yeah. So one had been severed at the wrist and one had been severed at the elbow. And investigators immediately believed that this had been done to prevent her from being identified. And they also thought that this likely meant that she had been fingerprinted before, either for a job or because she had some kind of criminal background. Mm-hmm. She also had expensive dental work, upwards of $5,000 to $10,000 worth of dental work done in, quote, the New York style, which I looked it up. According to Reddit, which was the only place I could find anyone who, like, knew what this was.
I'm not going to hate on Reddit as a source, though.
No. Well, because also when you look up this case and New York style of dentistry, mm-hmm. it just brings up articles that mention this fact, and no one can tell you what it means. But according to, like, a dental expert who uses Reddit, this meant, like, using crowns or fillers to give the appearance of a completely even or symmetrical smile. So essentially doing what veneers would do today, but, like, the hard way, because it was the 70s or early 60s, mm-hmm. or late 60s. So it was essentially cosmetic dentistry, and also very expensive dentistry. So they were like, okay, so she was at least at one point possibly wealthy. Mm-hmm. But also, the killer had removed several of her teeth. Mm. Which was not great.
I hope that was also postmortem.
Yeah, I think it was. Because investigators assumed that this was also to make identifying her more difficult. Mm-hmm. There was also evidence of sexual assault with a wooden block. Postmortem. Oh. They did ensure me that that Good. Was postmortem.
Anything awful, I'm just going to assume is
postmortem. We're going to assume that, yes, this woman was killed immediately by blunt force trauma, and then all this other bad stuff happened afterwards. There was no sign of a struggle, so she was found laying on, like, one half of the beach towel, and so it almost looked like she had been laying there next to someone, and investigators theorized that maybe she had been asleep when she was attacked, and also possibly that she knew her killer. Mm. But there was also no disturbances in the sand, and so there was another theory that maybe she had been moved there. So I was like, well, was she laying there when she was killed, or was she moved there?
Well, and also, I mean, how many days has she been there now? Like, this has been a couple of days mm-hmm. that, you know, have been transpired or whatever. But obviously she had to have been there for, how long does it take for a fly to lay eggs and for those larvae to hatch and turn into maggots? So, like, you know, however long that takes, plus the days of discovery, so.
Do you want to know what my next point is?
I'm going to take a sip of yeah. my drink while you tell me.
It was determined that she had been dead for at least 10 days, but possibly as long as 3 weeks.
Okay. And so how are you going to know that the sand hasn't been disturbed then? And how, yeah. like, has there not been, like, a windy day that...
Yeah. So as far as physical evidence... Which, again, it's like, okay, if she's been there for 3 weeks, how are we going on this physical evidence? There were tire tracks that were found 50 yards from where the body was, and then there were two sets of footprints that led to the body. I'm assuming that they didn't know about Sandra and her sister. So, like, I have no idea if those footprints were, like, other people who discovered her and didn't say anything.
Well, and also, like, what's the consistency of the sand, too? If it's, like, the real dry fine.
Yeah.
To where it's, yeah. Or is it, you know, more, like, moist or whatever?
Yeah.
Sorry for everyone for using that word. That's all I could think of. Damp.
Damp. Good word. Compact.
Yeah.
I've never been up to Cape Cod, so I wouldn't know. I want to go. Maybe I have. I don't know. Where'd I go? I don't know where I went for Jarek's sister's bridal shower. Somewhere up in Massachusetts, and there was water at some point. I don't know. So, for the investigation, police checked all of the vehicles that had driven through the area, looking for matches to the tire tracks. They canvassed the neighborhoods nearby. They examined the victim's clothes for any physical evidence that her killer might have left behind. And they scoured the surrounding area for the murder weapon, and obviously for, like, the hands. Mm-hmm. But nothing turned up. Simultaneously, they were faced with this enormous task of trying to identify their victim. Presumably, because of the advanced state of decomposition and the severity of the head injury, facial identification was impossible.
Yeah, she's been dead for 3 weeks. Yeah. Then, yeah, no.
No one said that outright, but I'm just assuming that that was the case. Her autopsy showed no specific or unique medical procedures or implants that could help identify her. Her dental work, although unique, didn't provide any leads. Investigators sent the records out nationwide, and, like, no one came back with any matches. And they also checked thousands of missing persons cases for anyone matching her description. And so, unfortunately, the case kind of went cold pretty quickly. They named their Jane Doe the Lady of the Dunes. And they buried her in October of 1974. Her gravestone read, "Unidentified female body found Race Point Dunes, July 26, 1974. Y'all could have put Lady of the Dunes on there. It would have been nicer. Okay. Are y'all ready to go down some rabbit holes?
Yep.
Okay. I warned Katie ahead of time. This is just, I don't even know. I got two additional episode topic ideas from just this. Okay. So you can go ahead and grab your dossier because your first two are coming up. So, investigators continued to follow up on their leads as best as they could, like, as they came. In 1979, the first facial reconstruction of the Lady of the Dunes was done in clay. And this would be the first of many renderings of her face. None of them look the same, in my opinion. So, you may look at your first picture. These are all supposed to be the same person.
Wow. Yeah, no.
I don't think not a single one of those looks like the same person to me.
Not even a little bit.
And I couldn't find a picture of the 1979 clay, like the very first one done. And like obviously you can tell like the one at the on the bottom right is like the latest one. But like some of them even have different hair color. It's like her hair was auburn. We know that. We could actually see that. They've got her face looking all sorts of different ways, and they made all these composite sketches and put these out there, and they were like, do you know any of these, like, 12 different women, I guess?
Well, like, at least two of these, if not three, look a bit older than 35. Like, she definitely looks older than 35. Yeah. She looks older than 35. She, kind of there.
They're not doing her favors with the hairstyles.
No.
Yeah, so, I don't know.
And there's, like, three different ethnicities, I'm saying, too.
Yeah. Well, and, like, I think this comes into play, too, because, like, they're having they're going to have leads that come in. There's one in particular, which is hilarious, that we'll laugh about in a little bit. It's, like, okay, if you're just trying to, like, match her to someone that you think matches her description, you have a lot of options right now. So, her body was exhumed in 1980 just to kind of re-examine it. Mm-hmm. I guess in 1980, they're like, our technology is so advanced now. They didn't find anything that could help. And then in 1981, Irish mobster James Whitey Bulger, I think is how you say his last name, became a suspect. He's your next picture. I just gave you a picture of him so you know what he looks like. So Whitey Bulger was an Irish mobster. During his first...
Oh, it looks like Bugler.
Bugler? Did I write it? No, sorry. Switch the G and the L. It's supposed to be B-U-L-G-E-R.
Okay.
I promise. I didn't look up how to pronounce it, obviously. So, during Bulger. What?
Bulger or Bulger?
Both are funny.
Yeah, they are. Not quite as funny as Bugler, though.
Oh, man. So during his first stint in prison, which was just for armed robbery and truck jacking, he was part of the CIA-sponsored MK Ultra program.
Cool.
Which
I've heard of that, but I don't know what it is.
Great, because that's my first...
rabbit hole?
No, that's my first other podcast episode that I'm going to do. basically, it was illegal human experimentation using drugs.
Okay.
And I think it was for, like, interrogation purposes, but it was, like, definitely illegal. Definitely done by the government. Mm-hmm. These are just fun facts about him. So don't feel too bad for him about being experimented on. He was also anti-desegregation, and he lit an elementary school on fire in 1974 in protest of mandated busing policies. Unclear if anyone was in the elementary school or not. He also might have been a closeted bisexual. Happy Pride. So Provincetown was known as a safe haven for the LGBTQ plus community in the late 60s and early 70s. We love it. And Whitey is what I'm going to call him because I can't say Bulger. Whitey was known to...
But I'm going to think it.
I know. Why, especially now. Whitey was known to frequent several of the gay bars in town. And, like, it's unclear if it was, like, he was known publicly to do that or if just, like, the people who go to the bars knew he was a regular there. Witnesses...
Which is also not to say that just because you go to a gay bar, that makes you gay.
True.
I mean...
Yeah, you can go to a gay bar and just, like, enjoy the scene.
Yeah.
I think he was also spending the night there.
Yes.
With people.
Or leaving with people.
Yeah. I think there was some more documentation about his preferences, which has nothing to do with this. It was just, like, interesting information. Witnesses had seen a woman fitting one of the Lady of the Dunes descriptions with him around the time of the crime. So they saw a woman with him around the time of the crime.
A woman with red hair.
A woman with hair.
Oh, Lord.
The woman with hair. I don't know.
She not even have auburn hair?
I don't know. They didn't describe what this woman looked like. But okay. Some of those women don't have auburn hair. Some of them have brown hair.
One looked like she had blonde hair.
Who knows? Who knows what this woman looked like? Whitey was also known to remove the teeth of his victims. Mm. So police were like, I don't know. You were seen with a woman. You remove teeth. You murder people. He was never charged with this particular crime. He was eventually charged with the participation in 19 murders and found guilty of 11. But he was murdered in prison in 2018. So we will never know. And according to several articles, there wasn't actually any concrete evidence.
Weird that he was murdered so recently. Like,
I know.
How old was he?
He was like 70.
Why bother murdering a 70-year-old man?
I was talking to my mom about that. I was like, you know, they murdered this mob boss in prison in 2018.
It seems like a waste of energy.
I know. Her theory was a mob boss in prison.
I mean, he's still got connections to the outside. Like, they're still
put hits out on people.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah. Good point, I guess. I mean, not condoning murder, but...
Just because he's in prison doesn't mean he's retired.
Yeah, just because you're in prison and old doesn't mean you're not a mob boss still. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Whitey's out the door. That was 1981. In 1987, a Canadian woman told police that when she was 5, which was in 1974, she had seen her father strangle a woman in Provincetown, which is alarming.
Is my next picture?
Not yet.
Okay.
But by the time Canadian police passed that information along to Massachusetts police, that woman had moved, and no one could track her down. So just this very disturbing story.
Why even bother going to police and telling people that? And, like, after all this time,
well,
why?
And probably her father was, well, her father's probably definitely dead at this point. But I don't know who to blame. I kind of want to blame Canadian police. Like, you guys didn't get an address or a forwarding address or a phone number. I mean, it was 87, but...
Why didn't they, you know, like, hey, while you're here, let's go ahead and call up the police there and we'll get you in touch with them.
Or pound out these details a little bit. Like, what was your father's name? Can we get a little bit more? So they were never able to track her down or verify this story. A woman in Maryland came forward at one point, told police that one of the renderings looked like her sister who had disappeared in Boston in 1974. but by disappeared, she might have just lost touch with her sister. It's super unclear. So that leads to nowhere. Investigators briefly entertained the idea that the Lady of the Dunes was Rory Jean Kessinger. That's your next picture.
All right.
And I kind of wanted to do a whole podcast on this girl because she is a fucking badass.
Ooh, she pretty.
I know, right? Okay, so Rory, and like she could kind of maybe match the description of maybe one of the, I don't know, like a prettier version of one of, I don't know. She's also very young, so like, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, I always looked young for my age. Now I'm sure I look old and haggard and my age,
you
but...
You do not, but... But she's, I think, like...
She looks closest to this one.
Yeah.
The cheekbones are right, and it's hard to tell because she's kind of looking down in the picture.
Yeah.
The nose is similar, and the eyes kind of look right, and like the... Kind of the brow bone, but...
Yeah. Well, let me tell you about her really quick. So, Rory ran away from home when she was 15, and according to doenetwork.org, she kind of got caught up with the wrong crowd. She got involved in, quote, gun running and drug smuggling. So, like, not the best. Nope. She's 15. She runs away from home. Who do you think she's hanging out with?
Right.
Like, not the best people. In January of 1973, when she was 24 and living in Pembroke, Massachusetts, a police officer knocked on the door of the house she was living in with a traffic warrant. This possibly could have been like a cover for a drug raid because I saw both things. I also kind of read two versions of this, but essentially he knocks on the door. Someone else is also in the house, but Rory flees out the back. She like runs out the back, possibly with other people, whatever. But she's running out the back. She's only wearing lingerie. So this officer sees her.
That's why I never just hang out around the house wearing lingerie.
So
because you never know when a police officer's going to come and serve a warrant.
What's
going
to happen. So this cop chases her down. And she, like, trips. And so he catches her. And he brings her back to the house. And she says that she has been sexually assaulted, and that's why she ran away, because she was trying to get away from her attacker.
Use the distraction.
And so this cop is like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll take you to my house to regroup.
No.
And call for help.
No. No. Red flag.
Right? Hard I know. Pass. I'm like...
Absolutely not.
I no. don't know.
Take me directly to jail.
I know.
Do not pass go. Do not bring me to your house.
Yeah, so this cop takes her to his house to call for help or backup or something.
If she wasn't sexually assaulted before, she about to be.
Right? Okay, so this is... I'm assuming that this is, like, the official story, which means, like, the cop story.
Yeah.
So while they're at his house, and he's, like, quote-unquote calling for help, the lights go off. And Rory grabs his gun from him, like, off of him. The lights come back on. She's pointing at him, pointing the gun at him. And she's like, sorry, but I gotta kill you. Which, like, yes, you do, Rory. Like, mm-hmm. This man is a predator. There is a scuffle. The cop gets his gun back from her, tackles her. At some point, her lingerie is torn off. And so now she is naked. Whatever. So he brings her...
If he was going to be a gentleman to bring her to his house, why didn't he also offer her a t-shirt or something to wear?
Yeah, because then he brings her to the hospital completely naked. I'm like, you couldn't give that girl a blanket?
A towel? Anything?
Like, come on, man.
Like, I know she apparently supposedly tried to steal your gun off of you, but she's still a human person worth of, like, she has her, like, let her have her dignity, damn.
Also, first of all, stealing the gun, that's on you as a cop.
Yeah.
Sorry. Second of all, after she does that, sure, handcuff her, maybe. And then go get her something to cover herself with. Don't bring her to the hospital naked. So they get to the hospital naked. She is given clothes by some compassionate human.
Because they respect human dignity at the hospital.
She tells investigators there, hey, now I've been sexually assaulted twice. Because to no one's shock, she is now saying that the cop has sexually assaulted her. Which,
and even if he didn't, which... He shouldn't have brought her to his house.
I know.
Like, that's on you, cop man. That's... If you did not sexually... If he didn't sexually assault her, he still made a huge mistake by bringing her to his house.
Yeah.
Because how are you going to fight against that?
I know. That's
dumb. So dumb.
So, of course, investigators...
Moral of the story is never be alone with people.
Yes.
Travel in packs of threes.
So, the investigators, of course, do not believe Rory. And so she grabs another officer's gun off of them, which, terrible office, terrible cops, but deserve every bit of this. And now she's like, I'm going to kill all of you fuckers. Unfortunately, she is tackled again. And this time she is handcuffed and she is taken to the Plymouth County Jail. However, on May 26th of 1973, Rory... sawed off the bars of the laundry room window using a smuggled hacksaw and climbed out the window using her bed sheets as a rope. There was a car waiting for her. She got into the car and she was never seen or heard from again. So she just disappeared into the wind and she's still a missing person today.
Hmm.
Also, apparently you can still see the marks on the bars on that, like, of that window at that prison. Or county jail, I guess. So, police are like, maybe the Lady of the Dunes is her. I don't know. She's a missing person. She's young. She could have been murdered by this rough group of people she hangs out with. However, they do eventually, I don't know when they do this, because I didn't look that far into it, but they do eventually get DNA from Rory's mother and compare it with DNA from their Lady of the Dunes, and it is not Rory. So Rory...
which actually is a relief, because I hope she's out there living her best life.
I know! I hope that Rory is, you know, I told my mom this story, because my mom's like, well, I hope she's still not a criminal. And I was like, I hope that she did what that pirate captain said he would do for Theodosia, which is move to Paris... reform his pirate ways.
There we go, yeah.
And just live in luxury. So I hope she, like, got out of the country and is just living her best life. She was 24 in 1973. So someone do the math of how old she'd be today.
No.
Okay. She would still be alive today.
73, 74 now.
She'd be 74. Cool.
See? So, I can math. I just need a minute. I've had a really long weekend.
Okay, I just did on my phone.
All right, Jared, cut all of this. But I brained it.
You did brain it. You did good job with brain. Okay. Your brain did good. So, it's not Rory. In 2000, convicted serial killer Haddon Clark, which is my second future episode topic, confessed to fellow inmates that he had killed the Lady of the Dunes. And this is a quote from him. I could have told the police what her name was, but after they beat the shit out of me, I wasn't going to tell them shit. This murder is still unsolved, and what the police are looking for is in my grandfather's garden. 4 years later, Haddon sent a letter to a friend with a drawing of a naked woman lying on her stomach with no hands, and a drawing of a map to where the Lady of the Dunes was found. In the letter, he also told his friend that he had killed a woman in Cape Cod. However,
I have questions and issues, but go on.
Haddon is diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. From what I read, there's a very, very detailed article, which is what convinced me that I was going to do an episode. Anytime there's a wealth of information about someone, I'm like, stuff for me. From what I read, he reminded me a lot of our Vampire of Sacramento. Not so much in the gruesomeness of his crimes. Robert Chase, I think was his name.
I'd have to have more details.
He was the guy who thought his blood was turning into powder.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Just in that he does have very, very serious mental health conditions. that he was not treating properly, and that was a big part of why he was, like, a big direct cause of why he was committing the crimes he was, but he was also making a lot of bad choices. So, he has this, like, diagnosis, and he's also made several claims since his arrest in 1992, and because of his mental state, police don't consider his claims credible. However, he made that claim about what they're looking for is in my grandfather's garden.
I have a thing there. But go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, they did go to his grandfather's former property. Mm-hmm. And they looked. And evidence did turn up. And I won't tell you too much about what it is, because I'm saving that for an episode. But none of it was linked to the Lady of the Dunes.
So, I don't know if this inspired this or not, mm-hmm. but I saw, I guess it was like a Facebook post of like a funny story about how a man typically helped his grandfather every year, like mm-hmm. Digging up his garden, mm-hmm. and then he unfortunately got arrested, so he wasn't going to be able to help his grandfather this year, and so he sent his grandfather a letter basically explaining that all of the evidence that was needed to put him away forever was, you know, buried there. Ooh. On his property. And so, obviously, you know, any correspondence is monitored. Yeah. And so the police went to his grandfather's house and dug up the garden. So he helped his, you know,
yeah.
He wasn't able to do it himself, but yeah. He tricked the police into digging up his grandfather's garden for him.
That's funny.
Yep. So that's yeah. immediately where my mind went to that little story that's, you know, like, obviously it might have some rooted in truth there.
Possibly.
Then I've got some other little bits of, you know, him claiming these things.
Mm-hmm.
How much of the things that he claimed were public notice at that point?
I think all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a picture that I didn't include of kind of the crime scene. It's like kind of a... It's a picture of her in the brush, so all you mm-hmm. can see is her legs
mm-hmm.
and I think her, you know, her backside, and the rest of her is covered by the brush. But I'm pretty sure they publicized that her hands were cut off, the way that she was found, and, like, where she was found, because they were trying to get as much information as they could from her.
I wonder if, since one was cut off at the elbow,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe she had a tattoo on that arm.
About that too, why one was cut so high up.
It might have been that he had some struggle at the joint.
Oh yeah.
And decided to try a different spot. Ooh. Maybe it was easier to cut through there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ooh.
I feel like some joints are a lot easier to cut through than others, but my understanding is that it's not an easy task.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Like, dismembering a human body is hard work.
Yeah.
Is my understanding of yeah. things. Not from personal experience, of course.
So you say.
Just ask any surgeon. They should know.
Didn't we do an episode about someone who, like, had to dismember or did dismember a body without using tools?
Mm.
Did I make that up? Is that some weird part of my brain that's like, I hope not.
We've talked about how people have, like, gotten tired halfway through.
Yeah.
Like, one person, like... started and then took a couple of days off, basically. Kept picking it back up again later. But yeah, no, I just wondered, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a tattoo because, you know, by removing teeth and hands,
yeah.
you know, those are two big identifiers yeah. there.
I don't know.
Maybe there was a tattoo.
Well, in 2015, Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, came to police with a possible identification. And I just want to say, I feel like this is the perfect example, and I know nothing about Joe Hill. Maybe he's a very humble guy. To me, this sounds like someone who has been told most of his life that he has really good ideas. And he, even if they're not great ideas, so Joe had been watching the 1975 film Jaws.
So he's an armchair sleuth, but I can't wait to see where this one's going.
Which, to be fair, Jaws was filmed in Martha's Vineyard mm-hmm. in 1974, Like, in the summer of 1974, and Martha's Vineyard is 100 miles south of Provincetown. And as he was watching it, he saw in the background a woman who was wearing blue jeans and a blue bandana.
I want to go watch Jaws now.
Well, I have the picture for you in your dossier of that extra. So he comes to police and he's like, look.
Can I look?
Yeah, you can look.
Look.
He's like, look what I have found for you. I possibly identified your victim. This woman is wearing a blue bandana and blue jeans. And it was 1974.
Case solved.
It was 1974, and she was within 100 miles of the murder. And I think some police were probably like, very good, Joe. Very good. We will look into this. But not only is that a terrible theory for several reasons that I don't feel like we need to go into, it's also completely
But Hannah, she also has hair.
Oh my gosh, I didn't notice that she has hair. She also has hands that could be later removed.
That's right.
Didn't think about that. This is also an untraceable theory because the extras were not credited in Jaws, so there's literally no way of knowing who that woman is. Also, everyone wore bandanas in the 70s.
I wore them in the 90s when the 70s fashion was being revived. I wore them with my bell bottoms and flower power t-shirts.
Wait, were your bell bottoms jeans?
They were. And I did have a couple of blue bandanas.
Oh, no.
Maybe it was me.
Your hair's kind of auburn.
Today.
Uh-oh. And you've got the hands.
I do. And I have a
tattoo on one of your arms. Oh, gosh.
So he probably would cut me off at the elbow. I mean, joints are definitely easier to cut through than straight up bones. That's true. So.
And if all you have is I don't know. I don't love the...
Well, I mean, did they specify that all of the cut marks, like where her hands were removed, was that also removed by this military tool?
I think so. Okay. Yeah. So, in 2018, Richard Hanchett, who was 60 at the time, began searching for his biological parents after his adoptive parents passed away. He took a DNA test and eventually found out that his biological mother was a woman named Ruth Marie Terry. In October 2022, the FBI contacted him and said that they had used investigative genealogy to determine that Ruth was the Lady of the Dunes.
Don't mess with me right now.
She's your next picture.
Don't mess with me right now.
I'm not messing with you.
So wait, they...
Yeah, like last year.
For real.
And don't
100%
worry.
100% the Lady of the Dunes has been identified.
She was
through
just
DNA.
Identified last Halloween.
Wow.
And there's more, which is insane. There's one more guy back there behind her.
No, I wanted to go I wanted to go look at the composites.
Yeah, I know. And I don't think she looks like any of those. Mm-mm. And her
closest is there, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
But it could just be because of the style of the hair.
And her teeth do look very nice.
Yep.
So good job on the dental work.
These two at the bottom are close because look at how... narrow the space between, you know, her eyes and her eyebrows. That yeah. one kind of, like, all of these others, there's a lot. Like, that one especially.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they're even looking at the right skull.
Also, who is this? What is that?
I don't know.
They put, like, a random...
Like I said, there's, like, four different ethnicities in these photos.
Yeah, it's... We'll obviously post all these for you guys to see, mm-hmm. and it's wild how different they all look. But yeah, so Ruth Marie
that
Terry.
Nose is closest.
Yeah.
They put that nose on either of these faces because her nose is real wide down at the bottom.
Yeah, and I should. I didn't print this, but I'll show you because it wasn't. You couldn't.
Wow! Imagine that. Like,
I
all
know.
Right, my adopted parents have passed on. It'd be interesting to find my biological parents. Mm-hmm. Also dead.
I know.
Not just dead. That's... Murdered dead. And a famous murderer. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, not famous, yeah. but like
I think that picture of her with the short hair is the most recent, like what she looked like closest to the 70s. So Ruth was born September 8th of 1936.
That's my birthday.
1936?
September 8th. Come on.
I know.
Maybe this is me in a past life. Maybe that's why I like dyeing my hair red.
And you've got the tattoo that obviously needs to be disposed of.
Clearly.
When they kill you. Well, I hope that the rest of this doesn't describe no. anything. Because Ruth did not have the best start.
Well, obviously if she has a child that she had put up for an adoption.
Yes.
I'm anticipating some
reasons. Well, I think she was very resilient based on what she started or how she started. Okay. So she was born September 8th of 1936 in Whitwell, Tennessee. And she was born to a very poor coal mining family. And I didn't write down the specifics, but I think her father had like 6 different children by like 3 different women. So she had a bunch of half siblings. She married a boy named Billy Ray Smith when she was 13. And according to her half-brother, one of her half-brothers, her and Billy Ray divorced, remarried, and then divorced again by 1957. So, like, rocky relationship. Yeah. Also expensive relationship.
I love you, I hate you, I love you, I hate you.
Yeah.
Well, also, I mean, yeah, the divorces are expensive, but marriages and weddings back in the day.
Yeah.
Nowhere near.
Oh, yeah.
The circus that they are today. Yeah.
So, after her final divorce from Billy Ray, Ruth, who was then 21, moved to Livonia, Michigan. And it was there in 1958 that she gave birth to Richard. And Richard was not Billy Ray's child. And we do not know who Richard's father was. And because she was, like, single, just moved to this town.
21, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. She does not have the means or the ability to take care of a child. Absolutely. Yeah. Made the right decision.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he was able to be adopted, and I hope into a loving home.
Yes, he very much was. Actually, her superintendent at the automotive plant where she worked, his name was Richard Hanchett Sr., which I think it was just a... I'm thinking it was just a coincidence that her baby's name was, like, that she named her baby Richard and that the guy who adopted him was named Richard. I'm not sure. But Richard Sr. and his wife Thelma asked to adopt her. I think she was, like, kind of looking and they were like, we'll adopt your baby. And they, like, paid off her debts or something. It was, like, it wasn't, like, through a service or anything. It was just kind of one of those, like, we're going to adopt your baby and we're not going to like buy him from you, but we're going to pay for some of your stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of. And when the adoption was finalized, Ruth then moved to California to kind of get a fresh start, I think. Mm-hmm. So this is really sad. Ruth had actually tried to reach out to Richard and reconnect in 1973 when Richard was a teenager. Mm-hmm. But Richard, quote, wasn't ready to connect. He, I guess, had gotten into drugs in his teenage years. And at the time, he was in the hospital for a drug overdose that had put him in a coma for 18 days. And I couldn't figure out, I don't think he was in a coma when she had reached out. I think he was just like, I'm not in a good headspace to do this. I don't want to do it right now. But, like, obviously he looks back at it now and is like, I really regret that I didn't take that opportunity.
No, I'm sure he's got lots of what ifs of, like, if I had said yes, come out, then maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So February 16th of 1974, Ruth married an antique dealer named Guy Rockwell Moldavin. And here's your last picture. So this guy, he's an antique dealer. And in the summer of 1974, so they get married in February, that summer, Guy traveled to Tennessee and tells Ruth's family that she has disappeared from their California home. And he's like, I don't know where she is. She just disappeared. her siblings later were like, he was very calm about it and just very nonchalant, just like Ruth disappeared.
Just let you know.
I'm just here to let you know.
Just so you're aware.
Yeah, just so you know. One of Ruth's brothers, James, who was described in one article as like the one that was closest to her and like her kind of her protector, he immediately went to California and hired a private investigator to look for her. And I don't know who the f*** this private investigator was and what the f*** he did. He reported that all of Ruth's stuff had been sold, that she had left the state on her own, and that she was involved in a religious cult.
And the private investigator probably got caught by Guy and was like, look, I'll sell a story, but it's going to cost you. So Guy probably bought off the private investigator.
Yeah.
Like, stop looking.
Yeah. So her family didn't report her missing. They just assumed that she had kind of run off. I think they said that she was kind of informally marked as deceased in, like, their family records. She wasn't formally reported missing, which is why when the police were investigating, she didn't come up.
Right.
But back to Guy, our buddy. So he had actually been married 3 times before he married Ruth.
How many of his wives were still living?
That's a great question.
Or their whereabouts known?
So, well, let me just tell you.
Yeah.
In April of 1960, his second wife, Manzanita Ryan, and her 18-year-old daughter, Dolores, disappeared. 4 months after his wife and stepdaughter disappeared, he married his third wife, a woman named Evelyn Emerson, and immediately conned her mother out of $10,000. He said he was going to use it to buy antiques and said he bought a sports car and drove to Provincetown under an assumed name. And, like, I think just never spoke to them again. In October of 1960, police found, quote, bits of human tissue and pieces of human body in the septic tank of the home that he had shared with Manzanita and Dolores. Now, that was never officially identified as belonging to, like, as being the remains of...
Right, it was just human remains. Yeah. Not...
They weren't, like, charging Guy with, like, they were interested in Guy because he had run off with $10,000.
Right.
So, they eventually found him living in New York. They arrested him and they charged him with grand larceny. So, he gets sentenced to 15 years in prison, which... It's 1960. If he had served his 15-year prison, he would not have met Ruth. He would not have killed Ruth. Presumably. Not, you know.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. But that sentence was suspended on the condition that he repay the $10,000. And this is what the judge said, the sentencing judge. Quote, it is my duty to completely eliminate the fact that I know what the suspicions are of our police department and our community. Which, what the fuck does that mean? It's your duty to... No, it's not. Is it?
I disagree. You need to go back to judge school.
I know. Like, or it's your job to put him in prison for 15 years.
Guy, go to prison for 15 years and then pay back.
Yeah. Or, like, garnish your prison wages to pay it back. It'll take a while. So, Guy was never charged with the murders of Manzanita and Dolores. I don't think their murders were ever solved. He's also suspected in the 1950 murder of a 28-year-old Henry Lawrence Baird and the disappearance and probable murder of 17-year-old Barbara Jo Kelly. And he, of course, died peacefully in 2002. In his home. 2002, 2020, I don't know. I might have written that wrong. He's dead now. He died peacefully.
Yep.
On November 2nd of 2022, Massachusetts State Police announced that they were seeking information regarding Guy Rockwell Moldavin in connection to Ruth's murder. So he's, like, officially a person of interest.
Now that he's dead.
I know. Ruth's family was finally able to bring her home after 48 years. According to a May 2023 article Part of her remains were moved to the Red Hill Cemetery in Whitwell and laid to rest next to her mother. Some of her remains are reportedly staying buried in Provincetown, and her family spread some of her ashes along the beach where she was found. And although he has complicated feelings, Ruth's son Richard says that he now feels at peace. And that is the story of the Lady of the Dunes.
Wow.
Which.
I enjoyed that one. I just.
And it was so much.
I have complicated feelings about, you know, using DNA for solving crimes. Like, on one hand, like, hell yeah, I'm all for it. On the other hand, like, it makes me nervous a little bit.
Mostly because we don't trust.
Yeah. I'm putting the picture of Rory back on top because I love her the most.
Yeah, she's nice. Yeah, I agree. Part of me is like, I want to do the DNA stuff because it was, full disclosure, it was through Ancestry DNA that they did it. And part of me is like, I want to do that because it would be really cool. I mean, not really cool to find out that one of my ancestors or family members was either murdered or a murderer. But it would be cool to find out that your DNA helped solve something. But I gotta have some lawyer read all that fine print because you, I'm not convinced that they don't have other stuff that they can use it for, you know? And I don't know what, I mean, I don't know. But anyways, I'm glad that they identified her and that there's peace to it. But it was so recent too.
I'm real happy that, that's why I was like, are you messing with me right now? Messing with me?
I know. So recent.
Well, if you want to see all the pictures of these people, including the, like, seven completely different facial reconstructions, you should check out our Facebook and Instagram at The Tales We Tell Podcast. If you want to see pictures but don't do the social media, go to our website, thetaleswetellpodcast.com. And if you want to support yourself and get some sweet, sweet swag, go to our Redbubble store, search The Tales We Tell. We've got several different logos, and you can put that shit on anything.
Hell yeah.
And if you want to support us but you don't need the stuff, you can become patrons at patreon.com, search The Tales We Tell. You get early access, commercial-free listening, sometimes some bonus content. We'll send you stickers and love notes and all that jazz.
Hell yeah. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye.